You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, July 6th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Hey, did you guys see that we were outed as Big Pharma shills?
Oh, what? Man.
All right, which one have you told?
Still waiting for my first check, but I guess.
They're really, really slow. Yeah, it's a satire site called thespud.com.
Oh,
wrote
satire.
A fake article about the group Anonymous hacked Big Pharma as if that were a thing.
Yeah, right. It's hackable.
Yeah, it's, if it's like an entity, like their database, Big Pharma's database, and they downloaded the list of all of their paid pharma shills, and they started releasing it. It's basically just a list of skeptics, including themselves. But the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is listed, along with all of its hosts.
Oh, my God. Great.
And I was listed separately as well.
Well, you get two checks.
I'm a double pharma shill. So it was funny. Of course, a lot of people are sending this to us on Facebook, which is great. But, you know, a few of it. This is the thing. I could never tell if they know that it's satire. A couple of the comments had the strong vibe that they didn't know it was satire. They thought that, like,
of course,
we were
course.
Really being outed as shills.
Unless they're trying to one up on the satire game here. But
yeah, that's the thing. You never know. Then there's like, then you tell them it's satire. Like, well, I was being satirical. Well, I was being satirical about you not being satirical about the satire. You can get to an infinite regression.
Oh, gosh.
Wouldn't it be easy to prove if somebody was a shill?
You think? Yeah, I think so.
Well, yeah. Anomalous finances, sure. The question is, would it be compelling evidence? Whatever was found, or any lack of evidence, wouldn't be compelling for them. Oh, he's just hiding his money very, very well.
Well, you'd have to hide it from the government. You know, and that's illegal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you declare it on your taxes, oh, yeah, I got $30,000 from Merck, you know, or whatever, then it's there. There it is.
They could, like, drive someone to your house once a month, and they just give you, like, a little envelope, you know, with a whole stack of cash in it. That'd be the fun way to do it. I'd make the guy meet me, like, at, you know, at a coffee shop, and I'd wear all black and sunglasses.
And he would, like, leave a briefcase and then walk away.
Yeah. And I'd be turning a newspaper, like, as he does that.
Yeah.
The drop.
Yeah, right? That's weird. Look, if I'm going to be a freaking shill, it's going to be on my terms, and it's got to be cool.
All right, Bob, tell us about the forgotten superhero of science this week.
Oh, I almost forgot about that.
Hey, for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Charles H. Townes, who is none other than one of the main guys directly responsible for lasers. And for that, he shared a Nobel Prize in 1964. Ever hear of him? Well, perhaps you have. But still, this guy was so awesome that I think he should be even more well-known than he may even be already. I think we mentioned this recently on the show. We talked about it a bit. Laser stands for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And it's essentially a coherent and monochromatic light. It has pretty much one wavelength, all moving in lockstep together in one direction. It's not the random wavelength sent in random directions from something like a white light bulb. And just very briefly, I'll cover how it's created. There's lots of different types of lasers, but generally they all do a similar thing by creating a population inversion by pumping atoms in a lasing medium with an intense light or electric discharge. So that basically creates excited atoms. The electrons rise up to higher energy orbits, and then they spontaneously just emit that. They drop to lower energy orbits, releasing the light. And if the atoms are of the same types of atoms and same types of electron jumps, then you're going to have the same exact frequency of light coming out. I think one measure, a good decent measure of a scientist or an inventor, is how well his invention is known and what impact it's had. And Townes, I think, has this in spades. I really don't think there's too many people in the civilized world that hasn't heard of a laser. It's just so common. And the Nobel Prize that he got and a few other guys got for that also spawned multiple other Nobel Prizes for science that used lasers in a critical way. So it was just an amazing impact. Now, of course, there was a lot of foundational work for lasers before Townes made his breakthrough. I didn't know this, but Einstein actually predicted stimulated emission in 1917. Did you guys know that? That was a major, major prediction. But a lot of the physicists at the time, though, they thought it was more of a theoretical concept rather than a practical concept. And boy, were they wrong. Now, when it comes to Townes, his main contribution was finding the conditions in which atoms could be excited. And he created those conditions. And doing that in the right way to emit more energy than they absorbed, essentially. This idea came to him famously on a park bench, which allowed him to create the first, it wasn't a laser, it was a maser, it was a microwave laser in effect. And it was used, his specific design was used for the very first laser as we know it today in 1960. And the guy who made that probably deserves mention, Theodore Maiman. He was of the Hughes Research Institute in Malibu. He was the first guy to actually create the laser. But without Townes, it wouldn't have been done quite that way at that time. Would have taken longer. So clearly, Townes was the inspiration. They, of course, physicists have some great things to say about him. Nobel laureate chemist Ahmed H. Zewail of Caltech, he said about Townes, he said he's one of the great physicists of the 20th century, one of the great ones. So yeah, I think this guy definitely deserves to be a household name, because I don't think he's one now. I mean, if you asked me 2 days ago, what was the name of the guy that created the laser, I would not have been able to tell you his exact name.
Dr. Evil.
So remember Charles H. Townes, mention him to your laser tag playing friends, perhaps when discussing the gain media used for zeptosecond lasing.
Yeah, it's zeptosecond.
Yeah. I was thinking of going with the octosecond, but I decided to go with zeptosecond.
What's a zeptosecond?
It's much smaller than a femtosecond or attosecond. So right after attosecond, I believe, and before yoctosecond.
All right, well, Jay, I understand that there are new sleep recommendations. How much sleep do you get, Jay?
I have actually very poor sleep.
You don't say.
Yeah, my problem is just I don't start relaxing early enough, largely because of the SGU.
Sure, blame the SGU.
But the bottom line is this, guys. Mm-hmm. Even if you sleep well, you should track your sleep, and you should be monitoring yourself to make sure you're getting enough sleep, to make sure that you have good sleep etiquette. Because it's not just the amount of hours of sleep you get, but it's the quality of sleep that you get, which is very important. So check this out. I thought that this was interesting. Very recently, the National Sleep Foundation, or the NSF, has revised its sleep recommendations. And this is due to a recent rigorous study that they conducted this year. The NSF has also consulted a wide variety of experts, and they did something that I thought was pretty interesting. So they had a symposium type of deal, and then the panel voted on what they think the alterations were needed to the existing sleep recommendation. And they basically voted in the new information. So I have a toddler, so the recommendations that they have for a toddler, 1 to 2 or preschool or 3 to 5. There's quite a variability between 1 to 2 and 3 to 5. They're saying that the sleep range should be 11 to 14 hours a night for a toddler, which is 1 to 2 years old.
Damn.
And a preschooler, 3 to 5, needs 10 to 13 hours. This is 14 to 17 year olds, and their sleep range is 8 to 10 hours.
But what's interesting is that a lot of high schools, this is a huge controversy when you have a kid who's in high school too. A lot of high schools start early. You know, the classes begin at like 7:30 in the morning.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're done at like 2:30 in the afternoon. The reason they do this is for sports, because they need need the time in the later afternoon for sports. But there's clear evidence that teenagers get too few hours of sleep. They get too little sleep, and that this is adversely affected by the ridiculously early start time. And that teenagers sleep more and do better in school if you delay the onset of classes by an hour, let's say.
That's interesting.
But it's just hard to muster the political will to do that.
Yeah, good luck getting around that.
No big surprise here, but adults 26 to 64 years old, their sleep range is 7 to 9 hours. Now, what they did was, and what is very interesting about this, is that this is the first time that this list has been assembled that is age-specific and that's been based on an extensive review of all the available information. So as an example, if we were to go back to the toddler 1 to 2 year old, they said that the recommended hours are between 11 and 14. The maybe appropriate hours are 9 to 10, and the not recommended were 9. So what they're saying here very obviously is, here's what they should be getting, here's what might be okay because everyone's different, and here's what is not okay. People in the vast majority of us are between 26 and 64, and they were saying between 6 and 10, depending on who you are, but you should not mm-hmm. get less than 6, and you should not sleep more than 10 hours. And that brings me to the next interesting thing. Did you guys know that there are sleep disorders where people oversleep?
Like narcolepsy?
Besides that, though, is there something?
Diseases can cause it, too.
Yeah, so oversleeping is a thing, and it can cause health problems if you do it. Diabetes, heart disease, there's a list of health problems that you could actually get just from oversleeping.
Bed sores.
And you could actually maneuver yourself into an oversleeping cycle where, you know, you're not getting good sleep. You know, so you get up for a few hours and you go back to bed and you sleep for a few more hours and then you just slowly get yourself to the point where you're just tired all the time. You never feel well rested and you never really are getting deep, good sleep, which is very bad, very, very bad health-wise.
It's interesting. The brain allows for that. It doesn't have a corrective mechanism to prevent you from going to sleep too much.
Well, the problem is that your sleep hygiene is critical to the quality of your sleep. Yeah, like hygiene meaning, you know, don't be blasting your face with bright light before you go to bed. That's a big sleep hygiene thing. Don't do anything other than sleep or have sex in your bedroom. You know, if you're going to read a book, sit in a chair. Read until you get tired, then move into the bedroom.
Do you know why that is, Jay?
I don't know why you shouldn't do that.
The reason is that you get micro naps. And then that disrupts your sleep cycle. So you don't want to be laying in bed, but tossing and turning or doing an activity that might, like where you're nodding off and then, but still sort of doing something. When you get into bed, you want to fall asleep within 20 minutes and then you're asleep and that's it. You want to avoid anything that disrupts your sleep cycle. So if you're reading, sit up in a chair, read until you feel like you're sleepy and you want to fall asleep, then get into bed and fall asleep. That's good sleep hygiene. You're correct about the bright lights, and in fact, there's been recent studies looking at the use of devices like iPads at bedtime, and it really is bad. It really does disrupt sleep.
Wow.
The thing is, we evolved without electricity, right? So our major clue to our brain that it's time to sleep is that it's dark. We actually tend to get less light throughout the day than we would in a more natural setting, and then we get more light at night than we would. And so we're sort of evening out our light exposure throughout the day rather than having it bright during the day and then dark in the evening. So for people who have sleep difficulty, it's a good idea to start to turn the lights down for like 2 hours before you want to go to sleep. You know, start turning the lights off in your house. Try to start to turn down any electronic devices basically to prepare your brain for sleepy time.
I'll give you a internet 10. 10, you know, top 10 list of things that are bad about sleep loss. If you're overtired, if you haven't been sleeping well for a while, in particular, right? If you have a sleep deficit that's, you know, not just one day, but multiple days, your sleepiness can easily cause accidents, can cause you to get into an accident or you to cause other people to have accidents because you're not fully dialed in. Sleep loss can also significantly inhibit how well your brain works. They say that it makes you dumb, and it does. Your brain operates slower. Your brain doesn't have the same recall. It's not processing at a level where you can understand things as well. Your memory goes. Lack of sleep can also have some serious health problems, heart disease, heart attack, heart failure, irregular heartbeat, high blood pressure, stroke, and diabetes, all from a lack of sleep. They say that 90% of people that have insomnia have some medical problem associated with it. Lack of sleep can kill your sex drive. That's one of the first things to go. You can also become depressed from a lack of sleep. It ages your skin.
Shit.
That's the one that got you, Bob, aging your skin?
No, it was a cumulative thing. that was the last straw that made me
that
say
was
oh,
that,
shit.
That sentinel.
It can make you forgetful. which circles back to the ability of your brain to function. It's also, you know, it does have an effect on the quality of your memory.
You know, what's funny. I have patients who like have that whole list of complaints, right? You know, they're perfectly healthy. There's no disease or anything. They're fine, but they're like, oh my God, I have terrible memory. I can't concentrate. I feel out of it all the time. I'm tired all the time. And then I ask them about their sleep. Like, oh, my sleep is terrible. I get like 4 hours of sleep a night. I'm like, did it ever occur to you that that might be the problem? And it basically didn't. They had like never made the connection between all of those symptoms and the fact that their sleep is crap. It's like, well, let's fix your sleep first and see if that takes care of your other stuff, because there's nothing wrong with them, you know, otherwise.
Exercise can click you back into a great zone very quickly.
Yeah, exercise is good. Exercise during the day, no napping during the day. Don't eat or drink right before you go to bed. Empty your bladder right before you go to bed. Sometimes people have to get a new mattress. You know, it's like your mattress is old and saggy. Get a new mattress. Do whatever you got to do to get comfortable in bed, and then make sure you have protected time. Get your 8 hours.
A couple more things on the list. Losing sleep can make you gain weight, and it could increase, Bob, your risk of death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you may have an actual sleep disorder, like sleep apnea, you know. It may not just be bad habits. If you have a major problem with sleep, especially if you're starting to get symptomatic, definitely talk to your doctor about it. Might be something totally fixable.
Hey, I got a lot of wonderful birthday wishes on my birthday.
Oh, you got to read the one you got, Bob.
I know.
It's awesome.
But one of my favorite, this guy, this really, he really nailed it. He says, this is from Scott. It's like, happy birthday, Bob. Mention this to your friends, perhaps when discussing metrics of chronology by systematic observance of planetary orbit in a heliocentric system. Awesome. Touché. Nice job, Scott.
An homage.
All right. Hey, did you guys take that puzzle, that science puzzle in the New York Times?
Yeah.
Yes. Damn it.
How'd you do?
As bad as everyone else.
I did very well.
Yeah, this is a very interesting puzzle, which I like because it teaches it in a very simple way a good lesson in critical thinking. So the puzzle is, and I will provide the link, and if you want to take it before you listen to the rest of the segment, go ahead. I also blogged about it on Neurological, so you could go there and I link to the puzzle. It's called the Quick Logic Lesson. Essentially, what the puzzle is, it gives you 3 digits. And then it says these sequence of 3 numbers follow some rule. You can try to figure out the rule by entering in number sequences, you know, of 3 numbers into the box, and then we'll tell you whether or not that sequence fits the rule or not. When you think you have figured out the rule, enter it in the box further below, and then we'll discuss, you know, what the real answer is. Apparently, 70% of people fall into a, you know, according to this survey, fall into a very common logical error when figuring out the puzzle. And I know this is something we talked about on the show before, but this is a nice, elegant demonstration. I've given it to a few people, and about half of the people I've asked to do it while I watch committed this error. So, the explanation after you give your answer to the puzzle talks about confirmation bias. So that's a good, solid, critical thinking concept to get across to people.
It's huge.
Yeah. You tend to seek out confirming data rather than negative data. So they explained it as people will enter in sequences that fit their hypothesis. And then when they get a positive response, they think, oh, I must be correct because I got a positive response. And they said that that's confirmation bias because you're not testing. You're not entering sequences designed to get a no answer because people don't like getting a negative response. That's really only partially correct. And while the lesson they were teaching is legitimate, there's actually a more subtle thought process going on here. There's something specifically called the congruence bias. Congruence bias comes from when you have a hypothesis to explain some phenomenon that you tend to only test your own hypothesis rather than also testing competing hypotheses. That's really, I think, a better description of what's going on here. So you think, all right, thinking in your head, I think that the rule is you double the number, right? So if you start with 1, it goes to 2 and then 4. 2, then it goes to 4 and then 8. So you put in a number sequence that follows the rule, and if you get a positive response, like, okay, that confirms my hypothesis. But the way science really progresses is that you have to do experiments designed to get a negative result, that you try to break your rule. And only if your rule survives every attempt that you have of breaking it do you get closer and closer to confidence. You can never really prove that your hypothesis is the one rule, and there aren't other versions of it that might also fit it. You know, unless it's something very, very specific, like, you know, the sequence of prime numbers or whatever. In this case, the rule was very simple. The rule was that each number in the sequence is higher than the previous number in the sequence. That's it. They don't even have to be whole numbers. They don't have to be positive numbers. It's nice. Very simple. It's so, and people had, the problem with that rule is actually a challenging rule because it's really hard to prove. Because it's so general. But the problem with that rule is it's designed to maximize the congruence bias, right? Because if you come up with any alternate hypothesis that involves increasing values, you'll get a positive response. So it subsumes a lot of other more specific rules. Does that make sense?
I saw it as that you're not, your first guess, you're not trying that. You're not trying to break some rule that you've already preconceived in your mind and starting off by starting to break it. You want to establish a rule in the first place and then go from there. So it makes sense that you are going to put in three numbers that are ascending, that in ascending order of some combination.
When I went through the test, you know, I just tested it systematically. My first guess was, like most people, maybe it's the doubling. So I put that in and it worked. Mm-hmm. Then you have to go, okay, well, let me see if I can come up with some other rule. I'll just do all even numbers. And that worked too. It's like, oh, okay. So that broke the first rule. So I said, okay, now I have to come up with some other option. So then I put in just random numbers and it was negatives. So now I have something to work with. It's like, okay, then eventually I figure out maybe it's just ascending. So then I just did ascending, but like numbers that were odd and there was like clearly no other relationship among them. And that also was positive. Yeah. But that's a really important lesson, because if you are trained to think scientifically or to think critically, or if you, like for me, I'm a physician, I do this every day. You know, I generate a differential diagnosis, and you know, I teach students, you can't just test your own idea. You got to think of all the possible alternatives. You got to test them too. So for somebody who has like a profession that is like science, or that is important, that is dependent upon investigation, going through this sort of sequence of events was intuitive and trivial. But for most people who don't do this, you know, they just tested their own hypothesis. When they got positive confirmation, they thought they were done. So this applies in everyday life. You know, we think of things and then we look for a positive example. And if we find one, we think that confirms our idea, rather than thinking, all right, can I turn this on its head? What if my idea is wrong? Then what would I expect to see? You know what I mean? So this does then dovetail with confirmation bias, because there's so many lessons. What I love about this puzzle is that the more you think about it, the more sort of critical thinking lessons you could derive from it. So another one, for example, is that the rule here was very non-specific, right? It was very simple in that the numbers only had to be higher than the previous one. You could also think of that as a very general or non-specific rule, right? As opposed to a very highly specific rule, which would there be some complicated mathematical formula that would determine the next number in the sequence. And there really would only be one next number in the sequence. That would be a very specific rule. So you could think about things like non-specific symptoms versus specific symptoms, or, you know, any outcome that really isn't specific to any one hypothesis. But if it happens to fit your hypothesis, you interpret it as if it were specific. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a big critical thinking lesson. Again, very critically important for medical students when I'm teaching them. It's like, yeah, so this person had a rash, and the rash is definitely a sign of that disease, but it's not that specific a sign, because you get rashes with thousands of other things too, right? So then you want to look for a pattern, you know, a pattern of signs. or of results that fit your hypotheses. And then you try to get more specific. Are there results that would only fit my hypothesis? And then again, you need to try to then to break your hypothesis and in order to really, really test it. So anyway, these kinds of tests, I think, are really instructive because they sort of force you to think. And then you can analyze your thought process, which, of course, is the important thing to learn in all of this. It's how, you know, to think in a systematic and logical way. But the harder part is to realize how this applies in your everyday life. This doesn't just apply to math puzzles. This applies to your thinking about everything. You know, how you make sense of the world, your political views, you know, when you think, oh, you know, whatever. I talk to people every day who use this kind of bad reasoning to justify their political views or their ideology. And they're not, you got to always step back and say, okay, well, how specific is it? Does it really, you know, what other hypotheses are consistent with this? Does this really establish my hypothesis? You have to sort of bake that into your thinking about everything. Otherwise, the default mode is just, you'll have a set of beliefs that have no relationship to reality. You know what I mean? They just, whatever beliefs you inherited or are consistent with your personality or your culture, your upbringing, whatever. But, and you'll be absolutely convinced that the evidence supports your beliefs, but it doesn't, because you're just falling for the congruence bias combined with confirmation bias. And obviously there's a host of other biases as well, but those two sort of work in concert to convince you that the evidence proves your hypothesis, even when it doesn't. All right, Evan, this is an interesting one about dragon lizards, which we saw when we were in Australia.
Yeah, we did.
We got some cool pictures of
those from the University of Canberra Institute of Applied Ecology. A climate-induced change of male dragon lizards into females occurs in the wild, and it's been confirmed for the first time, according to recent research. The creature of noteworthiness is called the bearded dragon lizard. Very cool. I looked it up online. It has very impressive statistics. Level 1, 10 hit points, armor class 15, 1d6 plus 2 damage. the researchers have long been studying these creatures, and they've been able to show that a reptile's sex determination process can switch rapidly from one determined by chromosomes into one determined by temperature. Lead author, Dr. Claire Hollily, who's a research fellow at the University of Canberra, explained, "We had previously been able to demonstrate in the lab that when exposed to extreme temperatures, genetically male dragons turned into females. But now they've been studying a group from 131 adult lizards in some controlled breeding experiments in natural environments. And the molecular analysis shows that some warmer lizards had male chromosomes, but they were actually females. So you've got this group of female bearded dragon lizards with male chromosomes. And then when you take that group and then you hook them up with males from the population, they breed with them, you basically have a new breeding line in which temperature determines the sex, which is really fascinating.
It's interesting, yeah.
Did anyone else think of maybe Jurassic Park when?
Of course, yeah.
when you read this, nature finds a way somehow, some way.
There are lots of fish that do that. You know, like if they find themselves in a population of all females, you know, one of them will convert to a male, and so that they could breed. There's also a recent study showing there are some animals. I think this is in a stingray, where this specifically happened. But again, if they find themselves in a population of all females, the females can reproduce asexually. These are sort of escape hatches. If populations find themselves without, you know, both sexes to breed, they still can have progeny, you know, from one of these fail-safe methods.
Comes in handy.
Which is, oh, that's a damn fine evolutionary trait, I suppose.
The sea anemone fish can do this. The clown anemone fish, in a population of all males, the dominant male will become a female.
Wow.
Bob, you're going to tell us about the maybe some limitations to the size of computer memory, theoretical limits.
Bob, tell me, please, we'll still someday have a Yottabyte.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that, I don't think. Yeah, so researchers have discovered an intermediary atomic state during the storage of data using a special type of memory called phase change memory. This is computer memory, of course, that could potentially impose a fundamental limit to the speed that that computer memory can be recorded. Now, have you guys ever thought how weird your computer is in that it uses two or multiple different, fundamentally different types of memory? So you use different data storage technology when, for example, you look at porn compared to when you quickly open a spreadsheet when somebody walks by. Two different types of memory. Some people can confuse these, but for generally, computer memory is temporarily stores information so it can handle and manipulate it very fast. So anything that you open up or use from your operating system to any file that you open will load that information into the random access memory or just RAM. And there's lots of different types of RAM, SRAM, DRAM, et cetera. It's great, but it's, relatively expensive. It's volatile, which is a key downside, which means that when you turn your computer off, that information is gone. Now, the other type is basically computer storage. Now, this is relatively slow as hell. But it's non-volatile, so this is like your hard drive, your SSD, your solid-state drive. It not only permanently stores your porn or your spreadsheets, regardless of whether your power is on or off. It's also cavernously huge and very cheap. I mean, we've got hard drives now that are, 4 terabytes or one drive at least? Probably go a little higher. Are they up to 5 and 6 yet? So, yeah, it's huge, cheap. Non-volatile, but just not very speedy. Universal memory, I don't know if you guys have heard of this one. Universal memory is basically a dream of the computer industry that combines the best of both worlds for RAM and for storage. It's basically computer data storage that has all or most of the following capabilities. It's non-volatile, will not disappear when the computer goes off. It'll be very fast. It'll have lots of storage capacity. It'll have millions of read-write cycles, which is something that the flash drive in your pocket does not have, and be relatively inexpensive. If you could meet all of those, you would have something that would make a dramatic change in the computer industry. Now, there's lots of different candidates for this universal memory, but one of the best ones that I've come across is called PCM. Or phase change memory. It could also stand for phase change materials. Now, the materials used in PCM have the ability to change the electrical resistance of tiny little sections of it when it's hit with an electrical voltage or a laser pulse. And this change essentially alters the atomic structure of the material. So it transitions from an orderly crystalline structure with low resistance, for example, to a more disordered amorphous structure with high resistance. Now, your computer can detect these differences very easily, and it would assign a 0 to 1 and a 1 to the other, depending on what kind of resistance there is. And that basically creates the fundamental unit of data storage, the bit. That's pretty important stuff. And this is commonly used today to store information on DVDs, Blu-ray discs, CDs, if they even are still around. And they use nanosecond pulses of laser light to do that. So PCM then can become quite an important part of our computers in the future. It can become very good at fulfilling this role of universal memory. It's very durable. You could have 100 million or more write cycles. Compared to like that flash drive, which only has 3,000. I didn't know that. It's also, PCM also performs better than flash memory. Although it's not quite as good as some types of RAM. I think DRAM, it's not quite as good as that. It's also non-volatile, of course, which might be probably the most important thing. And it could be very cheap to produce. But not only that, this one I had never heard before. It's not just good for something like universal memory, though. PCM can be used for logic operations. I mean, they're talking about potentially replacing silicon with this stuff. The reason why it's so attractive is that PCM can be much smaller and much faster than we can do anything with silicon. So, I mean, they're talking about laptops operating at 500 to 1,000 times as fast as they are today. So using phase change memory, you could also potentially be able to boot up instantly, which makes sense, since if you don't have to load anything into memory, that's the main reason why you're waiting forever for your computer to boot. PCM today is used, as I said, quite often in Blu-ray discs and DVDs, and they typically will use a nanosecond laser to do the phase change, and that takes a nanosecond is a billionth of a second. So to do it faster, though, you would need a faster laser. So they were looking at femtosecond lasers, and that could shoot a pulse of light that lasts one quadrillionth of a second, which is a millionth of a billionth. So much, much faster. So this could store data potentially a million times faster, which would be one hell of an improvement. So the scientists wanted to see what physical processes are actually happening during this time. So the scientists at Caltech used a process called ultrafast electron crystallography. And this is a new process that allows them to visualize femtosecond chemical processes that could potentially open up a whole new world to us. It does this by bombarding a sample of phase change material with a femtosecond laser. And then as the crystalline structure changes, they hit it with another pulse, but this time of electrons. And the electrons are scattered off of the material during that critical point when it's going through the phase change. And that's, those scattered electrons provide a pattern that allow you to see for the very first time how the atomic structure is changing during this type of phase change for a PCM. And what they saw was that before the crystalline structure phase changes into the amorphous structure, it first goes into an intermediary phase before becoming amorphous. And that's essentially the crux of this whole thing. That little intermediary phase is introducing a fundamental delay, which could potentially limit, give a hard limit to how fast these phase change materials can write data. Giovanni Vanacore is a postdoctoral scholar and an author on the study. He said that even if there is a laser faster than a femtosecond laser, there'll be a limit to how fast this transition can occur and information can be recorded. Just because of the physics of these phase change materials, it's something that cannot be solved technologically. It's fundamental. So one of our best candidates then for universal memory, phase change material or memory, has this unavoidable delay embedded in the process to make it work. But, you know, that's kind of okay, because wherever we look, physics is going to put up a wall that we can't go beyond. And we can see that wall approaching. And, you know, the speed of light or the smallest size that a transistor can be, you know, but once we know these limits, we can then work with the physics to get as close as we can. So PCM, I think it's clear that it will still very likely be an amazing advance if we ever just knock down the last few hurdles to make it ubiquitous. But it can be still an amazing thing in the computer, you know, for our computers. It could transform computer memory and logic operations, making them a lot smaller and a lot faster than they are now. And who knows? And perhaps we can find some other type of universal memory that doesn't rely on phase change, and we'll have another set of walls that'll be a little bit farther away.
Well, Jay, we're a week behind, but you're going to get us caught up on Who's That Noisy?
I am. So, what was this? 2 weeks ago, I played this noise. What do you guys think it was?
Something brief.
It sounds like somebody emptying a box of cereal with a toy prize inside.
Well, I was trying to come up with a joke for filet of fish, but no, this was the noise of the filet spacecraft, the lander, bouncing off of the asteroid.
Oh my God. Awesome.
Cool.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Now, don't worry, because when I say it bounced off of it, the gravity was so amazingly low that the ship did not have to travel fast in order for it to bounce.
So, a mile an hour.
Yeah.
Mile an hour.
It was moving incredibly slow, but that is the noise that they somehow recorded of the impact.
Yeah.
I could just see some scientists going like, oh, you know, like, what did that do to it?
Is it like an electronic recreation of a signal? Because doesn't the noise need a medium to flow through in order to create an
outcome? It does. Right. And that medium was the craft itself.
Yeah, I guess so.
That's my guess. That's my guess.
Yeah, I guess so, Bob. But this came right from the researchers who are running the project. You know, that was right from their mouth. So it did happen. But it didn't hurt the spacecraft, so we're all good. So I had one person write in. It sounds like the Philae lander's motor re-engaging. And that was sent in by Truckee Lynch. And that's a damn good guess, Truckee. And I'm going to give you three quarters credit on that one. Or you know what? I'll give you, instead of the typical three SGU points, you get one SGU point.
Yeah.
For guessing that one correctly. Thank you
one
for emailing.
One easily point.
Yeah.
So you guys have probably seen the news item this week about Philae finding evidence for life on the comet. Yeah, total crap.
Total crap. And I am disgusted with the FISORG website. They reported it hook, line, and sinker. This is what these scientists are claiming with no context at all, and saying that this guy has made tons of crazy claims over the years that clearly need to be factored into anything that comes out of his mouth.
Vikramasinghe,
yeah.
Yeah, he's been making a host of crazy claims about extraterrestrial life. He thinks everything is extraterrestrial. And there's also just a far simpler explanation for the carbon on the outside of the comet. You don't need to hypothesize. It's not contamination. It's just chemistry. It's just being produced by the comet itself.
Exactly. Yeah. It's chemical. It's not biological. There's plenty of artifacts that are created by chemistry that look like they might be biological. And he totally fell for that. And that's his narrative. That's his ideology. Yeah. So he would have failed your logic puzzle in a nanosecond, Steve.
Right. But it's scientists report that there may be life on the Philae comet. Yeah. Don't say which scientists. All right, Jay, what do you got for this week?
I have a really fun one this week, guys. This is something that I could confidently say that I believe that most of the listeners of the SGU have heard this several times. You are going to instantly, I believe, feel like you've heard it before. And then you're going to try to question, like, what the hell? Where did I hear that? How do I know that? And then some of you might guess it. So good luck. Take a listen to one of my favorite sounds. Is it strangely familiar?
Oh, jeez.
There are people that are going to write in and go, oh, my God, of course I know what that is, and give me all the details.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing how your brain can, like, store away one little chunk of information like that? You know, you may not have heard it in 30 years, but somehow when you hear it years later, it's recognizable, and you can kind of put your finger on it.
So, good guessing this week. Write to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, and also send me in any cool sounds that you hear, any ideas. I'd love to sift through those, and I will say your name if you guess it. I mean, if I pick yours.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Hey, we have a name not logical fallacy this week. This one comes from Dr. Robert Sears. Listen to this. This one is from a listener, Andre, who posted this on our Facebook page, and he wrote, in a San Jose Mercury News article today about the recently signed vaccination bill, this passage made me wonder what you guys would say was the logical fallacy or fallacies. Dr. Robert Sears, a Capistrano Beach pediatrician known for his unorthodox views on childhood vaccination, pointed out that only 70 of 120 state legislators voted for the bill. If vaccines were so good that they should be forced on everyone, 120 legislators would have voted yes, he said. So to give some context here, California recently passed a bill, and that was signed by the governor into law, banning non-medical exemptions for vaccines, which is huge. Mm-hmm. I didn't think anything like that would happen so quickly. Of course, we could credit the Disney measles outbreak
summoning the political will, their legislators,
to make this happen. We had a big debate about this in the science-based medicine group about what should our position be, like really draw a firm line at no non-medical exemptions, or say but in states that allow exemptions you should minimize them, you know, because they do correlate with higher compliance and better herd immunity, et cetera. And one of our arguments were, God, it's going to be really hard for states to give up like religious exemptions for vaccines. But, you know, a couple years later, they did it. In any case, so what error in thinking is Dr. Sears, who's an infamous anti-vaccine pediatrician, what error in thinking is he occurring here? If vaccines were so good that they should be forced on everyone, 120 legislators would have voted yes, he said.
Well, my first thought is that this is the total bullshit fallacy where, first off, he's making the assumption that all 120 were there. For all we know, 71 could have been there, and they all, and 99% voted.
My first thought was that what you're basically saying here is that only if you have a unanimous decision or close to a unanimous decision on anything, this bill or anything else, is therefore it somehow it's more valid than if it just goes through the normal process and, you know, passes normally. Therefore, it has to be all or nothing. And only if it's all, therefore it's good. If it's anything less than all, it's somehow bad.
Who gives a shit what state legislators think scientifically? I mean, if this was 70 of 120 scientists who this was their specialty, then he may have a point, like the 98% of climate scientists. But oh, look, I found a dentist who doesn't agree with the, you know, with climate change. So that's yeah. That's another thing. Like, you know, really, you're using politicians to assess how good a piece of science is? That's pretty stupid.
Yeah. So what logical fallacy would you say this is close to? I think it's a weird argument from popularity from authority.
Right.
Because he's essentially saying 50 state legislators voted against the bill banning non-medical exemptions. And if vaccines were great, those 50 wouldn't have dissented. So he's essentially appealing to the opinions of or the authority of these 50 dissenting state legislators, right? I mean, I think that's, you can kind of rework it that way. That's sort of the logic that he's used. That's sort of the implied logic of his statement. There's also just the false premise in there. His premise is that if there's a good bill, then you're always going to get 100% of legislators to vote for it, which is an absurd premise, right? I mean, I think we could all agree. That's a blatantly absurd premise.
So if you ask the 50 who voted against it, why they voted against it, I bet you they've got 30, 40, maybe who knows, 50 different reasons for not voting against it.
Yeah. Yeah, he's making an awful lot of assumptions. It's all motivated reasoning. It's like he's trying to find some way to minimize the implications of this vote.
Right.
It's, just, yeah. Yeah, it's all motivated reasoning BS. It's, the logic is so strained. It's actually challenging to try to figure out what his logic is. But it is, I do think, some twisted version of argument from authority. But there's a lot of false premises in there as well. All right. Well, thanks for sending us that question. We also have a couple of emails. Let's see if we can get to them, which ones we can get to this week. There's another question off the Facebook page as well. Hi, I was wondering if you could shed some insight into whether or not cruciferous vegetables such as Brussels sprouts and broccoli are really actually bad for your thyroid gland, or if it is all just overblown hysteria. What is the science behind that?
Vegetables or the hysteria?
Have you guys heard that? Cruciferous vegetables might cause problems with your thyroid?
No, I had not.
Good, because it's BS.
Now, a cruciferous vegetable, can we hang on and identify that, Steve, first? Can we start with that?
Cauliflower, cabbage, bok choy, broccoli, Brussels sprouts.
What makes a vegetable cruciferous?
It's from the family Brassicaceae, or crucifera. So it's just family of vegetables.
Is it derived from the word crucify or crucifix?
Yeah, I think so.
So it's like...
So anyway, so this comes from animal data. May not apply to humans.
Ooh.
Some cruciferous vegetables have substances in them that can compete for iodine in terms of being for uptake by the thyroid. So the thyroid gland needs iodine to function properly. Most of your iodine you get from seafood or from meat, but like the Western diet actually doesn't have a lot of iodine in it, which is why our salt is iodized. So we most of our iodine we will get as a fortification through salt. But let's say you're somebody who is a vegan and doesn't eat a lot of salt. You actually can have a diet that has too little iodine in it. And then in that case, it's theoretically possible that cruciferous vegetables may further exacerbate your low iodine uptake because It competes for the iodine for uptake by the thyroid. So that's, you know, that's a theoretical risk only in a very specific population. For most people, if you get enough iodine in your diet, you know, if you use salt in your cooking, you get plenty of iodine. Don't worry about it. Eat all the cruciferous vegetables you want. They're good for you, you know, like most vegetables.
I read that if you're worried about that at all, just to make sure that you cook those vegetables, don't eat them raw.
Yeah, but that's counterproductive because the raw vegetables or the lightly steamed or whatever actually have more vitamins in them. So you don't want to cook the hell out of them for this reason. Well, right. Just throw some salt on them. You know, most people avoid salt more than they need to anyway. This is a separate, whole separate issue, like the whole salt hubbub. But
that's it. 54 emails this week about salt.
Yeah. No, we have a couple articles about it on science-based medicine. Just the question of, are we getting too much salt? How much salt should we get? What are the proper recommendations? So the bottom line is, it depends on the country and the typical diet they have, but for like most Western country, like Japanese definitely get way too much salt in sodium in their diet. But for most Western countries, for most people who don't have a problem with salt, you know, you definitely don't want to overdo it, but you don't have to avoid salt. You know, I think some people take it to the extreme of like completely avoiding salt, and only a very small minority of patients, because they have kidney problems and blood pressure issues or whatever, have issues with salt. And essentially at that point, you should be following the advice of your physician. But otherwise, if you're just an otherwise, you know, healthy individual who doesn't have kidney disease, for example, just don't overdo the salt, but you don't have to avoid it. You can add a little salt to your food. You can cook with salt. And in fact, it's not uncommon for me to see patients in the summer who are feeling faint and lightheaded because they're too low in salt. You know, they're dehydrated and not holding on to their fluid because they generally avoid salt because they thought they were supposed to, and not really for any particular reason. And then they're not hot season adapted yet, so they lose a lot of salt in their sweat. And then they basically just get dehydrated and hypotensive and feel faint. And the solution's really easy. Just eat some salt. And then eventually we adapt. You know, we adapt to the hot weather. You lose less salt in your sweat the more heat adapted you are. This is one of those things that, like, there's a sliver of truth to it. Yeah, there were some animal studies that showed that this is a possible theoretical situation. But, like, for most people, this is not something to add to your list of things to worry about. Eat as much broccoli as you want. You know, you don't have to overcook it or anything. It's fine. It's healthy for you. Eat it raw if you like it that way. It's a nutrient-dense food, so it's good food to consume. And, you know, if you're somebody who has issues with thyroid, you'll probably know about it. All right, one more email. This one comes from Aaron Alcott from Ames, Iowa. This is a response to something we said last week. He writes, in listening to this week's podcast from 7/4/15, I heard it stated that a graduate-level science education is necessary to successfully divest oneself from pseudoscientific belief. I am not sure how that line is derived, but as one who has only finished high school, I can assure you that I do not buy into the pseudoscientific naturopathy magic BS thinking. Simply possessing basic intellect should be enough to spot garbage statements. That is all that I possess. Just thought I'd mention that not all of us uneducated slobs buy into pseudoscience. Thanks for your time. So there's two layers to this email I want to address. The first is, we never said that you need to have a graduate level science education in order to recognize pseudoscientific belief. So he's committing a specific fallacy where, you know, he's sort of changing what we said to make it mean not the opposite, but like the converse or something. I'm forgetting I might be not using the right technical term, but so like I said that increasing science education doesn't necessarily give you the ability to recognize pseudoscience until you get to really the highest levels of science education. That's not the same as saying that if you don't have a high level of science education, you can't recognize pseudoscience. First of all, this is statistical information. This doesn't say that everybody believes in pseudoscience if you're not at a high level of education. This is a if you remember, this was a response, Evan, to you saying that the answer to belief in pseudoscience is teaching people about science. And my point was, well, it's more complicated than that. It's not a simple matter of just teaching people about the science, because there's data which suggests that, statistically speaking, you know, this, now we're talking about a population, increasing science education doesn't necessarily decrease belief in pseudoscience. But you can't take that group data and therefore say that every individual follows a specific pattern. That's not an appropriate way to interpret data. I also want to talk about, what do we know about the relationship between science education and belief in the paranormal? It's actually a really complicated relationship. I was giving a summary of just one aspect of it that's counterintuitive to make a point last week. The short answer is, if you ask what is the relationship between level of education and belief in the paranormal or pseudoscience, the answer is it depends. It's not one simple relationship. It depends on what specific paranormal or pseudoscientific belief you're talking about. And it also depends on what population you're talking about, including what country you're talking about. The study I was specifically referring to was actually a study done in France, and it showed an inverse relationship in that as the higher education levels actually correlated with an increased belief in pseudoscience. So it seemed that the better educated people actually accepted more pseudoscience. Specifically in the survey that I'm referring to, astrology, I mean, belief in astrology was higher among the college educated than among the high school educated in France. In the United States, if you're asking about astrology, it decreases. In other words, college educated people are less likely to believe in astrology than people with a high school education or less. That's sort of the relationship that you would expect to find. But then why is it flipped in France is an interesting question. Looking deeper into the research, there are other studies which look at other things. Like, for example, there was a Finnish study that looked not only at level of education, but also at thinking style, either a strong preference for intuitive thinking versus analytical thinking. Also things like, you know, male versus female and length of university education and what your major was. So what's not surprising is that people who have an intuitive style of thinking had a higher belief in paranormal topics, and it was much less in people who were strongly analytical in their thinking style. They also mentioned that probably explains most of why women have a higher rate of belief in paranormal or pseudoscientific topics, except for UFO belief, by the way. So women are higher pretty much in everything in terms of belief in the paranormal, except for UFOs and alien visitations, where men outnumber women. I think a lot of it's cultural also. So there's a lot of things that are intersecting here. It's not only education level. It's also the culture. It's also how science is being taught. And it's just inherent thinking styles. So the one thing that we have the biggest control over is how science is taught. Another study trying to address that issue came to the conclusion that just teaching science alone does not reduce belief in related pseudosciences. Like, teaching astronomy won't necessarily reduce belief in astrology. But if you confront the pseudoscience as part of the science education, in other words, you juxtapose the belief in the pseudoscience right up next to the facts that are being taught and the logic and the reasoning being taught in the science, that drives down belief. So that's essentially what we advocate as skeptics, right? Not only just teaching science, but you're juxtaposing it to pseudoscience. You're teaching not only why science is right, you're teaching why pseudoscience is wrong. And by teaching why flawed beliefs are wrong, you actually teach people how to think much more than just, here's a list of accepted scientific beliefs that are accepted, you know, by the scientific community. And in fact, the researcher, Henry Broche, who showed, this is the, that in France, that the education, science education was not not driving down paranormal belief, did a follow-up study in his own class where he started incorporating teaching about pseudoscience and why it's wrong and how, you know, studies can go wrong and how claims can be faked and perceptions can be flawed. And then that started to reverse the trend, and that started to drive down belief in the paranormal and pseudoscience. So, yeah, it's interesting. You know, so it does support, you know, my basic premise last week that teaching science alone is not enough. It's how you teach the science, and specifically, you have to teach critical thinking skills along with the science, and you have to confront pseudoscience, which is a way of teaching both how science works by giving examples of what happens when the methods go wrong, and also how to critically analyze claims, which is part and parcel of science. I think that that meshes well with the basic approach that we take in scientific skepticism. Confronting popular beliefs in pseudoscience is a way of teaching science and critical thinking. The data over the last 10 years actually supports that approach. All right, well, guys, it is time for Science or Fiction.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. So, guys, one of our listeners sent in our interim statistics. Jay, you are indeed in the lead.
What? That's awesome.
So far this year.
Yes.
With my win last week, I'm up to 50%, so I think that puts me in second place.
What?
Bob, you got a lot of ground to make up.
It's July.
Yeah. Have almost half a year to go. All right, here we go.
Starts
There's
now.
Three regular news items this week. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Bob is.
Item number one, a recent study finds that gray squirrels are capable of solving complex puzzles rivaling primates. Item number two, a large genetic analysis finds that increased genetic diversity is associated with being taller and smarter. And item number three, a new technique allows examiners to extend the window in which the time of death can be accurately determined from 36 hours to 240 hours. Evan, go first.
Gray squirrels capable of solving complex puzzles rivaling primates. Rivaling primates, well, I suppose that would be the issue here, were this one the fiction. They might be capable of solving some problems or some puzzles. But rivaling primates, that's a tall order.
Yeah. I mean, I'll clarify that as non-human primates. That's kind of assumed, but.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
thank you.
I had assumed that, but. You know, wow, how big's a squirrel's brain? You know, what's going on in there? I don't know. Interesting. The next one about a genetic analysis finding increased genetic diversity is associated with being taller and smarter. Increased genetic diversity. Well, this one's probably the trickiest, maybe of the three. That one's tricky. The last one, this technique that will allow examiners to extend the window in which the time of death can be accurately determined from 36 hours to 240 hours. 240 hours, that's 10 days.
Yes.
Week and a half almost. Well, you take the square inverse of the cosine of 10, which is the log of 1. You add 3, and that's what you get. The problem with this one would be, obviously, you know, it's one thing to go maybe from 36 hours to 72 hours, but to go to 240 hours, you really made quite a leap there. But the one that is troubling me is about this increased genetic diversity associated with being taller and smarter. I got two problems here. I don't know how this taller and smarter tie together, or if they necessarily do, but increased genetic diversity associated with that? No, I don't think that's the case. I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. We got the squirrels. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of dramatic. My question is what kind of puzzles? There might be certain types of puzzles that they're just kind of optimized for, but it's not necessarily true that they could, say, do, you know, all the different types of complex puzzles that primates can do. Also, I mean, just because they're so tiny, I don't think matters. I mean, look at, what is it, the crow? So, you know, some birds can perform amazing feats of intelligence. So just because it's tiny doesn't necessarily mean it can't be done. So that, yeah, that's, yeah, that's
but
possible.
Bird brain's an insult.
Yeah, right. We'll go to the third one. Yeah, Evan's right. That's a huge leap. But, man, that's, oh, damn, that's, that would be a hell of an advance. I could kind of see, you know, some sort of biochemical evidence, something that they can use to track, like a ticking clock that they could actually determine time of death up to 240 hours. But still, that's a tremendous leap. And I'm really, really skeptical about that one. But I think I'm going to have to agree with Evan, though, that, yeah, it's something about, I'm not sure why the genetic diversity is being paired with the taller and smarter, because clearly they don't, taller and smarter don't need to go together. So, yeah, I'm going to say that one's fiction.
And Jay.
I will take these in reverse order, sir. A new technique that allows examiners to extend the window. I would agree with this one wholeheartedly because I know that this is first, it is a field of study. And, you know, between the organisms, the studying of like the organisms and the growth of those organisms, I would not be surprised that there was some recent headway made in figuring out, oh yeah, you know, when this thing reaches this stage, you know, this is how many days the corpse has been sitting here type of deal. So that, no problem with that one at all. This one about large, the genetic analysis about the diversity and being smarter and taller. This one seems perfectly cromulent to me that, you know, the healthier your genes are because of the diversity, you know, that there is a slow shift towards, you know, being more intelligent and being taller, you know, slash healthier. That one makes perfect sense to me. The one that really doesn't make any sense to me is the one about the squirrels being able to, I know that squirrels can solve complex puzzles. Absolutely. We've all seen squirrels do some amazing things trying to get at food and doing some incredible feats of puzzle solving and athletics. But no way do squirrels rival primates in their higher functions. That one's the fake.
All right. So you guys all agree on the third one, so we'll start there. A new technique allows examiners to extend the window in which the time of death can be accurately determined from 36 hours to 240 hours. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes.
This one's pretty cool.
How? Yeah, how do they do that?
Yeah, well, Bob, you pretty much nailed it. It's, you know, a biochemical change that's like a ticking clock. So this technique looks at muscle proteins. The muscle proteins and enzymes degrade over time, producing a sequence of breakdown products. And so by looking for those specific breakdown products, you can send time to within a high degree of accuracy up to 10 days.
Wow.
When the time of death was. Yes, this obviously forensically, this is huge. Because previously it was only 36 hours. After that, you could obviously estimate like how many days dead the person was, but you couldn't give like a really accurate time of death. But this extends that to 10 days, which is, you know, I can imagine there'd be a lot of situations where in that 1.5 to 10 day window, where very obviously there'd be a lot of cases where, you know, dead bodies were found in that time period. So, yeah, this is huge. Muscles are also very obviously the most common protein in the body. So using an assay that depends on muscles is very useful. And the results can come back within a day. So it's not that complicated or expensive a test. Yeah, and it only takes about a day to do it. So, yeah, this could be a real game changer. Most of the data has been done in pigs, but the researchers have validated their analysis with human proteins. But I think with human samples, I think they need to complete that, though. So they need to do more further sampling on humans to really lock it down before it'll be useful in you know, as actual evidence. But it's in principle, it's been nicely established. Yeah. So I don't know how long it's going to take now before it's like become standard procedure. It may still take a year or two, but it's just a matter of confirming the timeline in humans. All right, let's go back to item number one. A recent study finds that gray squirrels are capable of solving complex puzzles rivaling primates. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. You just don't think squirrels are that smart. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Squirrely.
Hey, yet Thank again, you. Sole winner. So what the study did show, they did look at squirrel intelligence, and they did the headlines, of course, are always a little hyperbole, saying gray squirrels are quick learners. But this wasn't complex problem solving. They were hiding hazelnuts in a grid pattern, and the squirrels were good at finding them, which is not that much of a surprise. It was like a 4x4 grid of wells, and the hazelnut was always hidden in two opposite corners. So they were testing to see whether or not the squirrels would figure out that they should look at the corners first, and to see if they figured out that, like, once they had one corner, that the other nut would be in the opposite corner. And they didn't really figure that out, but what they were looking at was the number of wells they would test before they would find both hazelnuts, and to see if their behavior became optimized over time. And it did, in that, not fully optimized, but the number of misses did decrease over time. So their behavior did improve with experience. So, but this is, you know, right in their sweet spot. They're literally hunting for buried nuts in a grid pattern. You know, that's kind of what squirrels do. It wasn't really complex problem solving, and there's no reason to think that squirrels have the problem solving abilities of especially the higher primates. So that part I made up. But, you know, it wouldn't surprise me, though, if squirrels, like Bob, you know, jays, I think specifically are the birds that have a lot of complicated problem solving capability through trial and error. They could, you know, work multi-step, you know, puzzles in order to get at food. They have tiny little brains. Remember, intelligence, as it relates to brain size, there obviously is a relationship, but it's a complicated one. Depends on the body size. And it's not just a simple ratio. It depends on the body size plus also how big the animal is, meaning that where you are along that spectrum, it's not only the ratio of brain size to body size, but normalized to the size of the animal. And then also, however, brains have different levels of complexity, you know, how wrinkled they are. So, like, for example, a 15 million year old monkey fossil that was found a few years ago, scientists just published a follow-up study where they, I think, did a CAT scan of the brain cavity, and they found that the brain was probably highly complex. Anyway, so squirrels, because of their lifestyle, they're pretty damn adaptive little critters, as anyone who has ever tried to keep them out of their bird feeders will attest. You know, they're pretty ingenious little buggers when it comes to finding food. Anyway,
but more importantly,
yes, but not primate level. So all of this means that a large genetic analysis finds that increased genetic diversity is associated with being taller and smarter. That one is science. The headlines, however, I don't like the headlines of the press release. Press release says humans evolved to be taller and faster thinking, study suggests. Study is not looking at all at evolution. It's just looking at genetic diversity. It's the way I said it.
The difference.
So the way they measured genetic diversity was by counting the number of times the allele from the mother and the father lined up, right? So if both your parents had a recent common ancestor, then they might have inherited identical copies of genes. And so if you have two identical copies, that means you got one from your mother, one from your father. And so that's a sort of an indirect measure of genetic diversity. People who have very few of these alleles lining up means that their parents are from a diverse genetic background. So this is a study published in Nature by Dr. Wilson and Dr. Joshi, and they found that of all of the factors that they looked at, that only those two, being taller and being smarter, correlated with greater genetic diversity in the population. They actually looked at more than 350,000 people from urban and rural communities. They analyzed the data from 100 different studies. So yeah, so they're just sort of going through 100 different studies, looking at the genetic data, and then doing this analysis. Now, surprisingly, the genetic diversity, just raw genetic diversity as they measured it, had no effect on health outcomes, Jay, like high blood pressure, cholesterol levels, the chances of developing diabetes or heart disease. So that they thought that it would, but you know, because that's sort of the conventional wisdom that the people who have greater genetic diversity are overall healthier. But at least in this analysis, they did not find a strong signal there. The only traits were height and the ability to think quickly or smarts. The authors do say the study suggests that these traits have been selected for over time, but that's not what the study was looking at. You know, it's kind of misleading to focus in on that sort of speculative implication of the study rather than what the study's actually showing, which of course we know is very, very common in press releases and subsequent reporting.
What a shock. Yep.
All right. Well, good job, Jay. You're maintaining your healthy lead.
I didn't even know I had one until tonight.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know if I'd characterize it as healthy.
Well, it's a little bit healthier this week than it was last week.
I'll give you that.
All right, Evan, give us a quote this week.
Here we go. It is true that that may hold in these things, which is the general root of superstition, namely that men observe when things hit and not when they miss, and commit to memory the one and forget and pass over the other. Which is something we talk about quite often.
Yeah, remembering the hits and forgetting the misses.
Remember the hits? Yeah. But people were thinking about this hundreds of years ago as proof. This was penned by Francis Bacon, according to a book called The Works of Francis Bacon, published in 1842 by Lord Chancellor of England and Basil Montagu.
Basil Fawlty.
Basil Fawlty. So in looking this up a little bit further, it appears that this is the first time this appeared in a book per se. But Bacon was quite a writer in his own right, but he would make essays. He would produce, you know, essays, collections of writings here and there that, you know, he never really got into a book. I mean, he did have, I think, two books.
He was the blogger of his age.
Attributed to him. Essentially, yeah. So a collection of blogs were finally put together into this book in 1842, and it became
kind
of
like Steve.
Yeah. 250 years from now, Steve.
Yeah.
All your blogs will be collected into awesome. A book. So that is.
It's amazing. This is, I think, a bias that we have. You know, we think about people in previous ages. I mean, this is Francis Bacon talking about 16th century, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
1561 to 1626.
Yeah, when you hear such modern thinking, you know, in the mouth of somebody 400 or 500 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
The philosophers really figured things out a lot earlier than we think in our conception of the arc of human history. And that's because we tend to think of like the Middle Ages, you know, or even ancient times, people were generally superstitious and didn't even know about science or anything. But you know, really smart people existed back then and they figured a lot of stuff out, you know.
I sure did. Bacon has been called the father of empiricism.
Yeah. Pretty much invented science. That,
you know.
Right?
That's pretty big. I know.
Imagine that.
Well, guys, this is the last show to go up before we leave for Vegas for the amazing meeting.
Wow. Damn, it's so
another amazing meeting.
It's coming so soon.
Looking forward to being on the Strip. It's going to be cool.
Yeah, yeah. And hey, there's still time if you want to go to Vegas and come to the amazing meeting. Speaker lineup is awesome. We're going to be doing together, we're going to be doing our first workshop, the four of us. The workshop is going to be on Thursday, and it's called How to Argue. We're going to be instructing the attendees on how to conduct an actual skeptical argument, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Then we have our dinner Friday night, including a show and auction, and then our live show from the stage Saturday afternoon. And, of course, we'll be hanging out all weekend. And, you know, it's possible that there may be some revelations, some of interest to our listeners.
What do you mean?
While we're at TAM, some interesting news might emerge. I'm
skeptical.
Yeah. Well, you never know. You never know.
Hey, all right, guys. But keep in sight what is most important. Why do we do this show, Bob? Why? To win science or fiction.
That's right.
That is why.
I know. Anything short of that is an absolute disgrace. Hang your head in shame.
Bob, you understand? I don't get many moments like this, okay?
You have to savor them.
All right, Jay.
And I will revel in it.
Savor away.
I created a monster.
Throw your brother a bone.
Soon your tongue is going to be all desiccated.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this week, guys.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
See you in Vegas.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.